The next case on this morning's oral calendar is the case of State of Minnesota versus Samuel Lewis Chase. Counsel, when you reach the podium, please identify yourselves for us and the record. When ready, counsel for appellant may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Eric Withall. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Appellate Public Defender's Office. I appear before this court today representing the appellant in this matter, Samuel Chase. Your honors, we're asking this court today to reverse Mr. Chase's conviction for receiving stolen property because the guilty plea was not valid. The basis for invalidity is that the accuracy prong of a valid guilty plea is not satisfied, specifically with the mens rea element for receiving stolen property.
Whether he knew or had reason to know.
Your Honor.
What I want you to address is why we are not able to look at reasonable inferences that the judge can draw as far as that reasonable knowledge or imputation of knowledge by the facts here.
Your Honor, I think you can make reasonable inferences on de novo review, and I think you can look at the judge's reasoning, and I think that the court can also draw its own inferences from the district court record. I think that you're absolutely right. You can draw reasonable inferences. I think you can rely on the complaint. I think you can rely on the transcripts of the plea hearing. I think you can rely on the transcripts of the sentencing hearing. I think that's probably the extent of the record that is before this court today.
The client admitted that the VIN plates had been removed. That's odd, correct?
I think that
I'm pointing out a lot of inferences that I see in this record, and I think you've got a steep uphill battle on this.
Well, thank you for pointing that out, Your Honor, because I did want to address that up front. And here's something that that's very important to consider. It's not just the circumstances that are contained in the record. It's also Mr. Chase's testimony at the plea hearing. So to address this example, and I think there are several others that are reasonable to infer that the property was stolen, like the VIN numbers, the badge, moving it around, the comments made by the neighbor. These are reasonable inferences from which you can infer that the property was stolen, right? Mr. Chase testifies, no, it's not. I didn't observe that. I didn't see that. Right in the transcripts, a quote from the transcripts right here. I think the judge asks him up front. This is Ms. Schwartz. This is the prosecutor. On page 12 of the transcripts, line 16. Okay, let's talk about the VIN plates on the Bobcat. Had they been removed? Mr. Chase. Not when I was there. I personally did not see them be removed. But they were. And then the follow-up question is
Did you just say he said, but they were?
He's acknowledging now that they were, but he's saying that he did not observe them being removed. I think that's the same as Mr. Chase conceding that the property was stolen in fact, that he's conceding that it was stolen in fact at the time of his plea. But that doesn't allow the court to infer when he knew that that the VIN plates were removed. He can know that for the first time from the complaint. But when they're asking him, did you see that the VIN plates were removed? His answer is in the negative. So to the extent that he's conceding the VIN plates are removed, we're talking about what his observations were.
I read that, I guess, differently than you did.
I did, too.
I read it that he wasn't there when they were actually removed, but he knew they were removed because he was painting it. How would he not know if he's painting it that they're not there?
I suppose it depends very much on where the VIN plates are on the Bobcat. If they're on the inside of the door and underneath the hood, I think that you would not be painting that area of the Bobcat. I don't know to what extent he was painting the Bobcat from the record, but if we're talking about reasonable inferences from the record, Your Honor, don't forget about Al Nasir and Sam that talk about how the court treats reasonable inferences that are inconsistent with guilt. And the other important thing to keep in mind is Iverson that says that testimony that negates elements of the offense that are not sufficient to satisfy the accuracy prong of the plea. This isn't trial. This isn't a credibility determination. This is Mr.
But the cases you're citing were trial, like Almazir was a trial. It wasn't a plea.
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor. Sam and Almazir are tried cases. We're talking about reasonable inferences that can be drawn from the record, and the reason why I'm citing to those cases is because they address how courts and other circumstances determining guilt treat inferences from the record. And I don't think that the standard for how to treat reasonable inferences should rule out in a guilty plea context inferences that are inconsistent with guilt, especially when you're faced with negating testimony in a case like Iverson, which actually is a guilty plea and not a trial. So I understand that there are inferences that this court can draw from suggestions made in the record here that are consistent with guilt, but his negating testimony, as well as the inferences that are inconsistent with guilt, are the problems with this
plea. His negating testimony, and I'm not reading the transcript, I don't have it here in front of me, but I am on page 6 of Respondent Counsel's brief, and that's where he has teed up questions from the prosecutor to Mr. Chase. And then just to follow up, Mr. Chase, so even though at that point it was suspicious and you knew it was stolen, you continued to work on that Bobcat, correct? And the answer is yes. And then prosecutor asks, was there also a trailer and a bucket that you took to a different residence in Elk River, correct? And he says yes. And those were also stolen, correct? And he says yes.
Yes, Your Honor. There's problems with those questions. The first problem with the question is that the question is a compound leading question that has three parts. When they ask him, you were suspicious, you knew it was stolen, and you continued working on it in one breath, no distinction between the questions in there. And Mr. Chase doesn't respond, yes, I knew it was stolen. He says yes. So I think this court has to try and infer from the transcripts what he was saying yes to. Again, I think there's multiple reasonable inferences.
Well, what about the question his own attorney asked him? After asking him about Mr. Miller moving the Bobcat from here to there and around different places, then he asked him about the neighbor coming over and speaking with his father, indicating that it was somebody else's trailer. And he asked him if he was aware of the information before the police came, responded, and he says yes. And then finally, and that made you think this was stolen property, true? Yes.
Yes, Your Honor, that is what the transcript says. I'd also draw this court's attention to address the move. So, like this court said, the reference in the question, and that made you think this is true, the attorney is referring to two things, moving the Bobcat and the neighbor's comments. I'll draw this court's attention to page 15 on the transcript.
But he continued, then the prosecutor asked him, but even though you thought it was suspicious, you continued to work on the Bobcat, correct? Yes.
Suspicious, and knew it was stolen, and continued to work on the Bobcat. Your Honor, to answer your first question about what the defense attorney is asking him, and that made you think it was stolen, remember, the defense attorney is referring to moving the Bobcat. On the next page of the transcripts, the court asks him directly what he meant by moving the Bobcat. Did you take the Bobcat and the other objects to another location to conceal it? Is that what you were doing? No. He denies that he was attempting to conceal it. What were you moving it for? I'll paraphrase, to make room for my dad's truck. That's not to conceal it. He offers negating testimony after he's asked specifically about moving it around. I agree that moving the Bobcat around could be inferred to be consistent with concealing it. Then he's asked specifically about, then Mr. Chase is asked specifically, why are you moving around? I'm not concealing it. I'm moving it to make room for my dad's truck. And then the other comment, and that made you think, the other thing referenced.
Stealing isn't the only element, though. It's receiving, possessing, and he acknowledges that he possessed it.
I agree, Your Honor. I think the purpose behind the questions of asking whether Mr. Chase was trying to conceal it is because.
Well, he may not have concealed it. I mean, the fact of the matter is he acknowledged that he possessed it, and that's one of the elements. It doesn't have to have both.
I agree with you, Your Honor. Again, what I'm trying to say is that perhaps the reason they're asking Mr. Chase about whether he's concealing it is to allow the record to permit the inference that you wouldn't conceal something unless you thought it was stolen. But he's saying, no, I wasn't trying to conceal it.
But But it seems as though in these facts, the testimony indicates that he thought it was stolen, but he didn't conceal it.
He possessed it.
Your Honor, I think that the only way to read these two questions on page 14 are at best a recitation of the elements, but they are not supported by evidence in the record that allow this court to infer that he knew or had reason to know it was stolen. If he doesn't see the VIN plates, he doesn't observe the badges are stolen, he's not trying to conceal the Bobcat. And then the neighbor's comments, I think this belongs, this trailer, not the Bobcat, I think this trailer belongs to somebody else.
You know, I think what
those are the four things.
Where we're having our standoff is on the elements of the offense. A person is guilty of the offense if they receive it, if they possess it, if they transfer it, if they buy it, or conceal it. It doesn't say and. He doesn't have to conceal the property. He can be in possession of it, which he is because he's working on it. Then we apply under the definition. We then apply, did he have reason to know it was stolen? You're carving out conceals, it appears to me, as an additional element.
The reason I'm pointing, I'm identifying the concealing.
He didn't buy it. We acknowledge that. And so I'll give you the benefit that he didn't conceal it. That wasn't what he was doing. He wasn't concealing it.
Your Honor, I already conceded that he possessed it, and I agree that that is sufficient for the actus reus element of this offense. That is not my point.
So he possessed it, and now we have to determine if the possession was with the knowing element.
Or reason to know, correct, Your Honor. And again, the only reason I'm talking about the concealing and why it's important is because it's possible to infer from the concealing of an object. That's what the other cases on receiving stolen property say. It's possible to infer from the act of concealing it, because if you're concealing it, you also possess it, of course. The act of concealing it that you know that the character of the property that you're concealing is that it was stolen. So I think that the concealing here goes to both the mens rea and the actus reus. It's a nefarious thing, concealing, right? So again, there's four things that the state is referring to in its brief that they're arguing that this court should be inferring from the record supports knowledge or reason to know. It's the concealing, which he negates, the VIN plates, which he negates, the badge that he negates, and the comments from the neighbor that he acknowledges the neighbor made. But if the neighbor's the only thing that he didn't negate, the neighbor's comments are the only thing he didn't negate, the neighbor's comments do not give him a reason to know or provide knowledge that the Bobcat is stolen. That's the point. That the only thing that Mr. Chase doesn't affirmatively say, no, that's not true, no, I didn't know, is just that comment. That's the best evidence in the entire record that he doesn't affirmatively refute. And that alone is not sufficient to satisfy knowledge, actual knowledge. I cited this case in my brief that says that you need actual knowledge to satisfy. The neighbor saying, I think that the trailer belongs to somebody else. First of all, he's not talking about the Bobcat, he's talking about the trailer. Second of all, belongs to somebody else does not mean that it's stolen or obtained by robbery. That doesn't identify the character of the Bobcat. The problem with this case is that there's nothing here from which the court can infer in this record that Mr. Chase had actual knowledge that the trailer was stolen, especially when his friend comes over and says, I bought this, I paid $4,000 for it, I'm paying you to do work on it for me. The court can't ignore that fact either in the record. I think the court needs to take the record as totality and not just...
Do, but the definition of the statute doesn't require that he have actual knowledge. It also is in the or rather than the conjunctive and says or reason to know.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. I couldn't agree more. But for reason to know, it's not just you should have known better from it. It's gross negligence. Reason to know means criminal negligence, that he had something substantial and identifiable that this court can identify in the record, a real thing that he didn't affirmatively negate in his testimony at the plea hearing. Remember, this is a plea. And that his failure to observe this substantial and identifiable thing grossly deviated from the duty of care.
Well, aren't there three real things here?
The VIN plates, the badge.
Mr. Miller.
Maybe five even, the paint.
Mr. Miller continuing to move the property around?
Negated by his testimony.
Okay, but aren't there three real things? That, the neighbor coming over and speaking with his father, indicating that the trailer belongs to somebody else, and the removal of the VIN plates. Aren't those three real things? And then he says, the prosecutor says, you knew it was stolen, but you continued to work on it, correct? Yes. And you're saying that his other answers to questions negate that direct answer?
Well, the foundation for the prosecutor's position of Mr. Chase's knowledge of the character of the Bobcat being stolen, he refutes all of that in his testimony at the plea. The plea is his opportunity to say what he did and what he knew at the time that he worked on the Bobcat. He says, I didn't know this. He says, I wasn't aware of this. If he's not admitting to it, it's not a plea. He has to admit to the crime at a plea, otherwise the court shouldn't accept the plea. We ask the court to reverse his conviction. I see I'm out of time.
And you'll have rebuttal if you wish. Respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and opposing counsel. The question before this court today is whether appellant pled.
Can you tell us your name?
Excuse me, Your Honor. I apologize.
For the record?
Robert Yount, appearing on behalf of Anoka County Attorney's Office for respondent.
Thank you.
My apologies. The question before this court today is, did appellant sufficiently plead guilty to the crime of receiving stolen property? The sole issue that appellant has identified on appeal is whether that was sufficiently accurate. And this record, as Your Honors were pointing out on the first oral argument, is amply sufficient. First of all, it shows that he had actual knowledge by his own testimony in the guilty plea transcript. That alone satisfies the standard. Second of all, it shows that he had reason to know it was stolen based on the whole circumstances of the record, as well as, again, his own testimony. And finally, there is nothing in the guilty plea that negates an essential element of the crime. Now, returning back to the actual knowledge requirement, this court, as we pointed out earlier, doesn't need to look any further than page 14 of the transcript, where it's very clear that they ask, granted with leading questions, but he responds in the affirmative each time. And that made you think this was stolen property. True? Yes. And then again, so even though at that point it was suspicious and you knew it was stolen, you continued to work on the Bobcat. Yes. Those alone, just in the four corners of the transcript, show actual knowledge that he's pleading to the crime. Now, as has been acknowledged by the Supreme Court, it might not have been a favored way of eliciting the testimony. For example, the Raleigh decision and the Nelson decision from 2010 and 2016, they do recognize that the preferred way of soliciting that information is through non-leading questions. However, they also distinctly held that the use of leading questions alone is not a reversible issue. So the mere fact that a district court or that counsel uses leading questions to solicit that information does not justify a reversal. Rather, the relevant inquiry is, does the record that was established through the use of leading or non-leading questions support all essential elements of the crime? And this speaks to actual knowledge that he admitted on the record.
What admission, if any, was there that the VIN had been replaced by another brand? The VIN?
Certainly, Your Honor.
You mentioned that in your brief, but.
Yes. The VIN number was, I should back up and say.
The VIN was a Bobcat VIN, and it was replaced with one for another brand of skid steer loaders, I understand.
There's actually two different things that were replaced, Your Honor. There was the VIN number that was replaced, and that would have been individual to the vehicle itself. There were also brand stickers for a Bobcat that were replaced and replaced with like a second brand, a Harvester brand or something like that. So there are actually two distinct things that would have made that vehicle identifiable.
Was the color of the painting consistent with the Harvester brand?
The color of the paint is not in the record, but what is in the record is that appellant was painting the vehicle within mere days of it being stolen. And so coupled with the fact that the VIN number was replaced, the fact that its brand stickers were replaced, and the fact that it was being repainted, presumably painting over the existing paint, I mean, all of those are affirmative acts that almost rises to a level of a cliche of how you conceal stolen property. And that actually goes to the second point, to the constructive knowledge, to the fact that he had reason to believe that this was stolen property. And I just want to pause here and talk about the appropriate legal standard, as I believe Your Honor, Honorable Werke pointed out, is this is not a question about whether there's culpable negligence or the model penal code. What we have here in the context of an accuracy challenge is, did the trial court make certain facts and make certain that those exist that can be reasonably inferred to defendant's guilt? And furthermore, from the Nelson decision, as cited in my brief, the real question in this context is, does the record contain credible evidence that would otherwise support a jury verdict of guilty on the crime to which he is pleading? And so those are the relevant lenses through which this court should analyze the question. Is there credible evidence that would support a jury verdict of guilty? And building off of those three points about the VIN number being replaced, the brand stickers being replaced, and it's notable that they weren't just removed, they were replaced, which is, again, an affirmative act of concealment. Coupled with the fact that it was being painted and the fact that it was being shuffled around the private property all within the manner of a few hours and a few days, that bundled together would justify a reasonable inference of guilt. But that's not it. There's actually two additional facts that are very important here that this court should rely on if it reaches the has reason to know standard. First of all, we have a neighbor coming over and telling them, you know, that's stolen. He admitted that in his guilty plea. His father knew that. That would put any reasonable person on notice that it was stolen, and that it justifies, again, credible evidence leading to the conclusion that he knew or had reason to know it was stolen. But perhaps more importantly is that we have a reasonable person in that exact circumstance, in his shoes, that thought that had reason to know it was stolen. It's his father. We have to remember that his father called the police reporting it stolen based on all of this evidence that we're talking about here today. So we have an independent person who observed all of these facts, and it led him to believe that it was stolen. So looking at the record itself as a whole, all of this justifies would justify a jury finding of guilt that he had reason to know it was stolen at the time. And that's not even including his own personal testimony in the guilty plea transcript, where they asked him very clearly, even though at that point it was suspicious and you knew it was stolen, you continued to work on the Bobcat. All that taken together would justify the constructive knowledge mens rea element of the essential element of the crime. And then finally, the last point I want to clear up is that there's nothing in the guilty plea that contradicts or negates the essential element of the crime. Now, true, in his guilty plea, he did say that he did not see the VIN number being removed. Now, appellant minces those words pretty finely, but the fact that he didn't witness them removed doesn't change the fact that they were in fact removed and replaced while in his constructive possession. Second of all, we have the badges. He says that he did not see them replaced. Again, that minces it pretty finely because they were removed and replaced in his constructive possession while he was working on it. And finally, we have the issue of the fact that it was being moved around the property, or the fact that he took the trailer and the bucket and he put them in a separate property itself. Now, he offers post hoc justifications for why he may or may not have done that, but that doesn't negate the essential element here because he moved it and shuffled it around after he had reason to know that it was stolen. I mean, this Bobcat appeared on his property. He started working on it. All of this stuff was happening, all these circumstances showing that it was stolen. And yeah, he moved the stolen property to outside to a different property. And again, in his plea colloquy, he says, and there was also a trailer and a bucket that you took to a different residence. Yes. And those were also stolen, correct? Yes. So he again confirms that, yep, those were stolen, then I moved them. He might have moved them for a different reason because his father asked him to, but that does not negate, specifically contradict, the element that he knew that it was stolen or had reason to know that it was stolen. And so unless this court has any other questions, respondent would ask that this court affirm the entry of conviction and not reverse on grounds of an improper guilty plea. Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's important to also consider in this case what a good guilty plea would look like. The respondent has cited.
We don't see a lot of those up here.
I think that you see the ones that we challenge, Your Honor. And I mentioned at the beginning of my argument that Mr. Chase's acknowledgments in response to the questions on page 14 appear to be more of a recitation of the elements. The respondent is cited to Nelson, and that's a first-degree murder case. And that is a case where I think it provides an example of what a troubled plea might look like in contrast to a good plea or a bad plea. So, you know, the hypothetical I propose to this court is for a first-degree murder plea, if a defendant comes up and says, I killed her, I meant to kill her, I thought about it beforehand, that's not a sufficient plea because he's not admitting to the facts that he grabbed the knife, that he stabbed the victim, that he planned to stab the victim, that he intended to stab the victim and cause the death by the stabbing. He needs to admit to the facts of what he engaged in order to satisfy the elements. Rule 1501, subdivision 1, subpart 8, the procedures that the Supreme Court promulgated for a good guilty plea require the defendant to enter a factual basis for his plea. This is,
well, of course, we don't use the word good. The question is whether it was valid. So what do you think would have made this a valid plea that's missing?
I think that if the follow-up question to did you observe the plates, the VIN numbers being removed, if he says, I saw the VIN plates being removed,
But what does it matter if, because he does seem to say they were removed.
The point is whether this court can infer what Mr. Chase's actual state of mind was at the time that he was in possession of the Bobcat. So, and under the facts of this case, Mr. Chase is approached by a friend. Hey, will you do work on this in exchange for money? I paid for this Bobcat, it's mine. And I think that's a very important fact that appears at the beginning of the complaint because it goes toward Mr. Chase's state of mind at the time that he's performing work on the Bobcat.
But
so I understand.
But you have other information that's developed later and yet he continues to work on the Bobcat.
He needs to admit that those things are true. And he can't testify, no, I wasn't trying to conceal it. No, I didn't see the VIN plates removed. No, I didn't see the badge stickers being replaced. Yes, that happened. We're not saying that the complaint is full of lies. It's about the mens rea element. That's Mr. Chase's state of mind at the time that he's in possession of the Bobcat, not whether the facts that are developed later, if he were aware of them, would have been sufficient to create in his mind a reason to doubt that the Bobcat was actually what his friend told him it was. Because I think the fact that he was told that it was a bona fide purchase on the front end is very different than, you know, some of the other receiving stolen property cases, like the one with the cattle where the two guys come and sell the guy the horse or the cows from the back of the truck and they pay substantially less and he keeps them different from his livestock in a different spot. You know, that's a different case. I think the important thing to avoid conflating is this notion that Mr. Chase saying, no, I didn't see the VIN plates being removed or I'm not concealing it as not credible. That's a function of the finder of fact at trial. This is a guilty plea, and it's his opportunity to admit the factual basis for why he has a reason to doubt it, and not because it's what the district court at sentencing characterized as a, quote, great plea, because he's really pleading guilty in exchange for probation and not because he committed a crime to avoid the risk of getting sent to prison. Because at the time that he committed this crime, it was a presumptive stay, and then he got involved in drugs and got convicted in controlled substance offenses, and that added criminal history points. So what would have been a presumptive stay all of a sudden now is an executed sentence. So as they state in the transcripts, they take into consideration the fact that they offered the guy that brought the Bobcat over, Miller, a gross misdemeanor sentence, a downward durational and dispositional departure, and decided to offer Mr. Chase the same. And he went to prison because he didn't show up to sentencing. We ask that you reverse the conviction.
All right. The matter has been well argued. It is taken under advisement. And that concludes, well, it doesn't conclude our oral calendar, but our next cases are by TV. So we will recess while the TV is being set up. Thank you.